The picture had just changed to the lottery draw with a shot of colourful balls bouncing around inside a clear perspex sphere. A plunger suddenly lifted a single-numbered ball clear of the chaos and tipped it down a curving wire track. It was the number 7. The plunger descended before rising to select another number. It repeated the procedure 6 times, but Steve was paying no attention. He was too busy correcting Simon's mistakes. "And the 2 and the 8 can't go there," he almost sniggered. "And the bonus ball is..." Simon sipped his coffee and smiled to himself as he waited for the tannoy to announce that the flight for Orlando, Florida, was ready for boarding. Chapter 10. Steve woke midway across the Atlantic. He woke with a start, in response to some kind of impact. Squinting through the disorientation, he focused on his surroundings. They sat just behind the wing on the starboard side of the Virgin Atlantic 747. Simon was sleeping soundly in the window seat beside him. The aisle seat was empty. Steve was shifting round in his seat when the plane suddenly kicked up beneath him before dropping away just as suddenly. An overhead locker made a hollow clunking sound, and Steve could see a small rucksack lying nearby in the aisle. He looked round as a flight attendant drew level with his seat. She retrieved the rucksack and reached up to stow it back in the locker. She tucked in the straps and gave the door a healthy slam to make sure it did not pop open a second time. "Where are we?" asked Steve.
"We've got a few hours to go yet," replied the attendant. "Can I get you anything?"
Steve shook his head. "I'm fine, thanks."
"Don't worry," said the attendant comfortingly. "We'll be through this in a minute."
Steve did his best to look reassured. "You should try a low-altitude insertion through the boiling thermals of the Colombian jungle," he thought. The attendant gave him a parting smile and returned to her duties. Steve sat up in his seat and straightened the blanket over his legs. The plane gave another lurch, and the fold-down tray on the seat in front dropped open, coming to rest against his shins. He pushed it back into place and settled back in his seat, but a moment later the tray was rubbing against his legs once more. With an irritated sigh, Steve reached forward and slammed the tray back up, with more force than was necessary, and in his mind he saw his fist make contact with the door to his living room, with a good deal more force than was necessary. It was 5:30 in the morning, and Christine had just returned from the police station. Her brother had been picked up earlier that morning for a breach of the peace outside a casino. The police had called to say that, while he was not hurt, he was in a state of some considerable distress, and would she come and collect him? Christine had left, leaving Steve in the house with Sally. When, after a couple of hours, Christine had still not returned, Steve phoned her on her mobile. "Is everything all right?" he asked. "How's Paul?"
"Paul's fine,"
Christine had replied, but Steve could hear the tears in her voice. "What's the matter?" he asked, bracing himself in anticipation of bad news.
"I'm heading home now," said Christine. "I'll see you in a few minutes."
The very fact that Christine had dodged the question told Steve more than he wanted to know. "Okay," he said, a cold, sick feeling spreading through his stomach. "See you then." The next 10 minutes felt like an hour, as Steve waited for Christine to return. Finally, her car pulled up onto the drive, and Steve went to meet her at the door. Christine was obviously upset, but instead of seeking comfort in Steve's embrace, she pushed past him into the living room. Steve followed, the sense of foreboding growing ever stronger. His wife stood in the middle of the room, her back to him, her hands held up to her face. "Christine?" said Steve, reaching out to her, but before he could touch her, Christine let out a sob.
"It's gone," she cried. "It's all gone."
"What's gone?" asked Steve warily.
"The money, Steve, the money. It's all gone."
Now Steve knew exactly what she was talking about. She was talking about the capital they had raised for the launch of their new business venture, the £300,000 that represented every last penny of their assets.
"That's not possible," said Steve,
unwilling to accept what she was telling him.
"I spoke to the bank manager only last week. It's not possible."
Christine rounded on him, the bitterness etched on her tear-streaked face.
"This is Paul we're talking about. Believe me, it's possible."
Steve felt as if the ground had been torn from under his feet. The room seemed to suddenly tilt around him.
"But that's all the money we have," protested Steve.
"I know," said Christine.
"That's the money my father left me."
"I know," said Christine in a low moan.
"That's the house, Christine. We borrowed money against the house."
"Steve!" shouted Christine in frustration.
"I know!"
"Shush," said Steve in response to the raised voice. "We'll wake Sally." He pushed the living room door to, but it never stayed closed, and even as he turned back to the room, it swung open several inches.
"Oh, God,"
said Christine, raising a hand to her mouth and turning away.
"Jesus,"
swore Steve softly, as the enormity of what she was telling him sank in. They were 4 weeks away from signing a deal that would see a bank matching their money. 4 weeks from the start of production on the first of nearly 200 orders, and each one worth the best part of £5,000. They were 4 weeks away from ensuring the financial security of their family and proving that Steve could do something worthwhile in life, other than fighting for Her Majesty's armed forces.
"What are we going to do?"
said Christine, sinking into a chair.
"But how?"
asked Steve, still wondering how Paul could have gone through 300 grand in less than a week.
"Oh, you name it," said Christine angrily.
Steve shook his head, the shock giving way to anger.
"I knew we shouldn't have trusted him." "So this is my fault?" challenged Christine. "For talking you into it?"
"No," said Steve, somewhat taken aback.
"But if I hadn't talked you into it..."
"That's not it at all," protested Steve.
"But I did, Steve. I did talk you into it."
Christine was back on her feet.
"Oh, he's fine for a night down the pub. Great for a laugh. Great with Sally."
"Christine, don't," said Steve, taking a step towards her.
"No," snapped Christine, pulling away from him. "You never trusted him, not really. If I hadn't persuaded you that he deserved a second chance, that the responsibility would do him good."
"You didn't talk me into it," said Steve. "We made the decision together."
He made another attempt to comfort his wife, but she just kept turning away from him.
"I like Paul. I always have. I knew the way he was. I just never believed he was capable of something like this." "But maybe I did," cried Christine,
and the guilt in her voice was more than Steve could bear.
"Christine, please," he began, but she cut him off. "Steve, what are we going to do?"
Now it was Steve who turned away. He could not believe that Christine was blaming herself after all that she'd done.
"Enough," he said quietly. "Just let me think." "We have no money."
Steve sighed wearily. As much as he'd always liked Paul, he hated him at this moment. He hated him for his selfishness, for his weakness. He hated him for what he had done. But most of all, he hated him for what this was doing to his family. He and Christine never argued, not really. And he hated to see his confident, resourceful wife reduced to self-doubt and despair. Steve raised his hands to massage the growing ache in his temples, while behind him, Christine paced back and forth, sounding off the miseries that lay ahead of them.
"The mortgage is due next week, and we're already 3 months behind."
Steve could hear the blood rushing in his ears.
"How could he do this?" "Then there's the loan for the research costs."
Steve's heart was pounding in his chest.
"He knows what this means to us. He knows what this will cost us."
Steve's hands withdrew from his throbbing temples. the joints of his knuckles cracking ominously as they tightened into fists.
The car will have to go back. We won't be able to get Sally to school.
How could he do this?
Steve, what are we going? I don't know!
Shouted Steve, and lashing out, he punched the half-open door. Even in the grip of angry frustration, Steve knew that something was wrong. His awareness had registered two sounds, two impacts. His fist denting the solid wood of the door, and then, a fraction of a second later, a second impact. And there had been something else. The tiny, choked-off whimper of a little girl. Steve stood there, frozen to the spot, as Christine moved past him to open the door. There, lying insensible on the hall carpet, was Sally, their 5-year-old daughter. There was blood on her face, and her perfect little nose looked misshapen and nudged to one side.
"Oh, God,"
whispered Christine, kneeling down beside her daughter.
"Oh, Christ,"
breathed Steve as he looked down on the two people who meant everything in life to him. Sally stirred as Christine bent to check on her. She tried to open her eyes, but her left one would not open, the previously unblemished flesh starting to redden and swell.
"Lie still, baby,"
said Christine as Sally began to cry.
"Steve,"
said Christine in a voice of cold necessity,
"get me a damp cloth and the first aid kit from the kitchen."
As a trained nurse, Christine knew what to do, but Steve just stood there. Years of combat and training to deal with crisis situations had not prepared him for this.
"Steve, a cloth, please,"
said Christine in that same harsh tone of control. Steve started towards the kitchen.
"And phone for an ambulance," Christine called after him. "I want to get her checked out."
Steve grabbed the first aid kit from the kitchen cupboard and rinsed a clean cloth under the tap.
"Oh my God," he thought. "I put my daughter in an ambulance, my little girl, oh my God."
Steve's vision was blurred with tears as he made his way back to the hall. He handed Christine the first aid kit and cloth, then went back into the living room to call for an ambulance. "They'll be here in a few minutes," he said in a hollow voice when he returned to the hall. Sally had stopped crying, but she still snivelled and moaned while Christine tried to keep her from getting up.
"Is she okay?" asked Steve.
The paralysis of shock was starting to leave him, and he went to crouch down beside Sally. But Sally recoiled from him in confusion and fear, and Steve backed away in dismay. He had never had a reaction like that from his little girl before. But until now, he had never given her reason to fear him. Never given her reason to doubt his love.
"Just leave her," said Christine,
her tone softening a little as she nodded Steve back towards the living room. Feeling more lonely and worthless than he ever had in his life, Steve went and sat in his comfortable living room. He listened to his wife's gentle voice as she soothed and reassured their daughter. He listened as the ambulance arrived and Christine briefed the paramedics on Sally's condition.
"I think she's okay," Steve heard her say. "But she did lose consciousness, and she's complaining of a sore neck. I didn't want to move her."
"You did exactly the right thing," one of the paramedics told her, as he bent down to examine Sally. "Now, what happened?"
Steve had passed through the brutal psyche evaluation of the SAS selection process, where would-be recruits are placed under severe psychological stress to simulate what they might experience during interrogation by the enemy. Psych Week was notoriously difficult to endure. This was worse. Steve had watched the ambulance drive away. He'd waited until the police arrived with the social worker in attendance to take a statement from Steve and assess whether remaining in the family home represented a danger to Sally. He had waited until Christine phoned to say that Sally was going to be okay. She had a broken nose and a badly bruised face, but there was no serious damage done, and her nose would soon be just as perfect as it always had been.
"Kids mend remarkably well," Christine had said.
"Kids shouldn't have to fucking mend," Steve had rebuked himself.
"When can you bring her home?"
he'd asked.
"We're going to stay at Mum's tonight," said Christine, tentatively. "Sally doesn't want to go home just now."
Sally doesn't want to come home just now. The words had echoed in Steve's mind as he felt himself shrinking away to nothing.
"Listen," he said at last. "I'll go up to the cottage for a few days. You come home when you're ready. Give me a call when Sally's ready to see me."
"Okay," Christine had said.
Not, "Okay, darling." Not, "Okay, I love you. See you soon." Just, "Okay."
Steve had never felt so miserable, so hopeless, so guilty in his life. He had packed a bag, grabbed the keys to the cottage, and stalked out the front door, walking straight into the florist, who was delivering a big bunch of flowers and a large, incredibly cute Nemo cuddly toy.
"Delivery for Brennus," said the florist brightly, but one look at Steve's stony expression and the smile faded from her face.
"Fucking typical," Steve fumed to himself. Typical of Paul to think that a bunch of flowers and Sally's favorite Disney character could make up for ruining their lives.
"Just leave them in the hall," Steve had said ungraciously. "Close the door when you leave."
And with that, he had climbed into the BMW and driven away. Had he paused to read the note that came with the flowers, he might have been less harsh in his manner, more puzzled perhaps, but certainly less rude. But he did not read the note. He had only assumed that the flowers were from Paul. But they were not. If Steve had bothered to read the note, he would have seen that the flowers were, in fact, from him.
And that was that. Steve had spent the rest of the day talking to bank managers, lawyers, and his accountant, trying to see if there was any way out of the hole that had swallowed them. There was not. It all came down to money. When you had it, your options were limitless. When you did not, those options dwindled to zero. Now it was all about damage control. Retaining the house, salvaging as much of their lives as possible, but this too came down to money. Steve had to find a way of earning money and earning it fast, and he could think of no way quicker than £3,000 a day for the next 5 days. Steve pressed the tears from the corner of his eyes and tried to get comfortable in his seat. He pulled the blanket up over his chest and closed his eyes, searching once more for the oblivion of sleep. For another 30 minutes he fidgeted and wrestled with his blanket, his body mirroring the churning anxiety within him. And even when his breathing finally grew deep and regular, his blanket refused to lie across his body, and a frown of worry refused to leave his face. And as sleep finally brought relief to Steve, Simon opened his eyes. He looked across at his sleeping companion, an unreadable expression in his eyes. Then he reached across and pulled the blanket up around Steve's shoulders. He envied Steve, the refuge of sleep, as he waited in frightened anticipation for what he knew was soon to come, for the next confession to begin. He waited for the pain and fear of the latest victim to become so great that it burst, unbidden, into his mind. He closed his eyes once more. He was tired, and the distant sound of the aircraft's engines had a soothing, soporific quality to it, but still the repose of slumber eluded him. There would be precious little sleep for those condemned to die.
Chapter 11. Thursday, March the 3rd. Missing. There is growing concern for the welfare of psychiatrist Dr. Patrick Denning, who disappeared last night after giving a public reading of his new book, Silencing the Voices. A police spokesman has said that it is too early to conclude that anything untoward has happened to Dr. Denning, and they are continuing in their attempts to ascertain his whereabouts. There is, as yet, no evidence to link this disappearance with the abduction and murder of Dr. Marcus Bryant, the psychologist whose body was found earlier this week. The main terminal of Orlando International Airport was lofty and bright. The faceted glass ceiling allowed the early morning Florida sun to flood in, bathing the homogeneous airport facilities in a flattering light. Simon and Steve sat in the food court, just across from the Krispy Kreme donuts counter, while they waited for their connecting flight to Fort Lauderdale.
"How can you eat those for breakfast?" asked Steve, nodding towards Simon's second blueberry donut.
Simon said nothing as he licked the powdered sugar from his lips, but his eyes flicked to the empty McDonald's packaging that lay beside Steve's coffee cup. Both men felt tired and somewhat crumpled after the long transatlantic flight, but the coffee was finally starting to take effect, and the brightness of the day made it easier to function. Steve drained the last of his coffee.
"Shouldn't we be making a move?" he said.
"We've got a few minutes," said Simon.
"Not many," said Steve, looking at his watch. "We still have to get over to the airside terminal."
But Simon was not really listening. He was staring past Steve towards the south side of the terminal, where people were coming through from the check-in desks.
"Come on," said Steve, pushing back his chair. "We're going to miss our flight."
He reached down to grab his bag, but when he straightened up, Simon was no longer in his seat. Steve felt a moment's alarm at Simon's sudden disappearance, but he soon spotted him striding away across the terminal. With an exasperated sigh, he shouldered his bag and started after Simon. He had just about caught up with him when Simon called out to a middle-aged man in a smart blue suit.
"Captain Kern," said Simon, in a tone of friendly deference. "I thought it was you."
He held out his hand to the somewhat baffled-looking man.
"Christ, not again,"
Steve said to himself, swerving away from Simon and trying to appear casual as he hovered nearby. Captain Kern turned a puzzled stare on Simon.
"I'm sorry, I don't," he began, shifting his bag as he automatically reached for Simon's outstretched hand.
"Kings Bay last June," said Simon. "I never got a chance to thank you for smoothing things out with Commander Tully." Captain Kern looked none the wiser for this information, although he smiled stiffly as he tried to place the young man in front of him.
"I hope he didn't hold you to that promise," Simon went on in a knowing tone. "I don't think Stephanie would appreciate having him down at the lake for the whole weekend."
Captain Kern's smile looked more strained than ever.
"Well," said Simon, "best not to keep New London waiting."
At this, Captain Kern's eyes narrowed in suspicion, and, a few meters away, Steve's ears pricked up.
"Thanks again, Captain," said Simon, bringing his other hand to clasp Kern's.
And there it was again, that fleeting spike of intensity, as Simon's eyes pinioned the older man. Captain Kern was clearly mystified, but even as his lips parted to formulate a question, Simon let go of his hand and began to move away.
"Goodbye, Captain," he called over his shoulder. "Say hello to Commander Tully for me."
And with that, Simon walked away, heading for the AGT station and the train that would transfer them to the airside terminal. Steve lingered for a few seconds, watching as Kern turned to follow Simon with his eyes. He could see the indecision on Kern's face. Would he let this strange encounter pass? Would he call Simon back? Would he call airport security to find out how this young man knew he was flying up to New London? "Naval Submarine Base, New London, Connecticut," thought Steve, "the submarine capital of the world." What the hell was Simon playing at? Finally, Captain Kern turned away from Simon, and, with his brows still knitted together in thought, he continued on his way. Steve let out a sigh of relief and hurried to catch up with Simon.
"Don't tell me," said Steve, falling in beside Simon on the AGT platform.
"Never seen him before in my life," said Simon, with a sideways smile, as the train pulled up in front of them. Steve gave Simon a withering look as the doors slid open and they stepped onto the train.
"What's going on?"
asked Steve, taking a seat beside Simon.
"Two naval captains on opposite sides of the Atlantic? That's not a coincidence. Just what are you playing at?"
For a moment, Simon looked at Steve as if he were a stranger who was not entitled to know such things. Steve was surprised at the hardness in his eyes. Then his expression softened, Just a little trick I learned from the Trojans, said Simon, and the smile came back to his eyes as he turned to look out of the window. Steve raised his eyes to heaven, wondering just what had he got himself involved in. The flight to Fort Lauderdale was a short hop of an hour, but it gave Steve a chance to pose a few questions. And this time, he would not settle for stony silence. These questions concerned their security. I need you to get me out, Simon had said. Steve would have his answers. So what makes you think we might have trouble leaving the country? Steve asked quietly when they were airborne. Just a feeling, replied Simon. Yeah, well, your feelings are starting to give me the creeps. Simon offered a wry smile. Welcome to my world, he said. Steve gave a gentle snort. He could not believe he was starting to believe this whole psychic thing. Seriously, he said, if there's some reason why we might have trouble getting out, I need to know. Simon nodded his understanding and began. The James Randi Educational Foundation is a world-renowned institution that actively challenges claims of a pseudo-scientific or supernatural nature. Anything that cannot be demonstrated to be true. Spoon-bending mediums, interjected Steve. Exactly, said Simon. But some of them are pretty convincing, argued Steve. There's this guy in America, John something. He's a medium, gets pretty close to the truth a lot of the time. Simon raised an eyebrow at Steve's familiarity with daytime television programs. And do you believe he can talk to the dead relatives of people in the audience? He asked. Of course not, said Steve. And that's the point, said Simon. If he were able to demonstrate his ability in a reliable way, if he were able to prove that he really can talk to the dead, then it wouldn't be a matter of belief, it would be a matter of fact. Steve nodded, and Simon went on. The same goes for bending spoons, reading people's minds, prophesying the future. They call it precognition, said Steve, with a glint in his eye. Quite, said Simon with a smile, but the same thing applies to all of them. Namely, that it's not possible to demonstrate they are real. Not to skeptics, you mean, challenged Steve. Not objectively, clarified Simon, not to people with an open mind. Would people with an open mind not be prepared to accept that it might be true? Asked Steve. Yes, admitted Simon. But having an open mind also means being prepared to accept that it's not true. So none of these claims are actually true, stated Steve. That's right, said Simon. Because they can't be proved objectively? Exactly. So, urged Steve, hoping that all this was heading somewhere. So why do governments around the world spend serious money on paranormal research? Steve just looked at Simon. The Americans, the Russians, the Chinese, even the Europeans, they all believe there might be something in it, or at least they cannot afford to dismiss it out of hand. Steve felt a chill run down his spine. Even during his military reconnaissance training, they were taught never to look directly at the subject. There was this enduring notion that the target might somehow feel the eyes of the enemy upon them. Imagine someone who could break the White House's lost leaf code system, Simon went on, or someone who could bring down an F-22 Raptor using nothing but the power of thought. For the first time in his life, Steve was starting to appreciate the ramifications of a true psychic existing in the world. So what are you saying? He asked. I'm saying that the powers that be cannot afford to ignore the possibility that someone, somewhere, with genuine psychic abilities, might one day exist. Steve's eyes narrowed. I'm saying that they're working to find them, and that they keep at least half an eye on the kind of places where someone might just turn up. You're saying that the Randi Foundation is being watched? Asked Steve, finding the idea somewhat less than credible. Simon nodded. So, what, asked Steve, is the place bugged? Do they have a man inside? Let's just say one of the JREF staff members has been, approached.
Christ, said Steve. I feel like I'm in an episode of the X-Files.
Simon's smile did nothing to undermine the seriousness in his gaze.
Okay, let's say I buy into your conspiracy theory, said Steve. Although his expression suggested otherwise, who exactly would be watching? The police? The FBI? The media?
Let's just call them an agency, replied Simon. Steve raised a hand to his forehead.
Please don't tell me you want me to protect you from the fucking CIA, he said, in a hushed tone.
Despite what people might like to believe, the CIA were not the bumbling incompetents that they were often portrayed to be in the media. If the CIA did not want them to leave the country, then that would be that. End of story.
No, said Simon, much to Steve's relief.
Let's call them a private surveillance agency that happened to have certain government organizations on their books.
So what kind of resources might they have? Asked Steve, going through the automatic procedure of gathering intelligence.
Cars, said Simon, cell phones, standard surveillance equipment.
Steve's anxiety was steadily diminishing. Some latitude with the law enforcement authorities.
Steve's anxiety stepped up a notch.
And helicopters,
added Simon, as if it were an afterthought.
Helicopters? Repeated Steve.
Well, a helicopter, amended Simon. But I thought I should mention it, as it might be difficult for us to get back to the airport without being followed.
Damn right, snapped Steve. Could not believe that Simon had not told him all this before they left the UK. Being away from Christine and Sally for a few days was one thing, but being held in America as some kind of threat to national security was something else entirely. Steve took a deep breath and tried to get things in perspective.
Okay, he said. These guys are not linked to the police.
Not officially, said Simon.
And they're not CIA or FBI?
No, Simon reassured him. Not directly, he added. Steve gave him a severe glance before sitting back in his seat.
So we're talking about some kind of freelance security firm carrying out a passive surveillance operation?
Precisely, said Simon.
And what are they waiting for? Asked Steve.
Why, for someone to succeed in the challenge, said Simon, as if it were obvious.
What challenge? Asked Steve.
The $1 million challenge, said Simon. A standing prize to anyone who can demonstrate genuine psychic ability.
And how many people have tried? Asked Steve.
Oh, I don't know, said Simon. A couple of hundred, maybe.
And they all failed?
Everyone.
And you think you can succeed? Asked Steve.
Well, if I can't, replied Simon, I won't need you to get me out of the country, will I?
Much to Steve's relief, their arrival at Fort Lauderdale Airport had been pleasantly uneventful. Now they stood at the Avis car rental counter, just across from the terminal building. The woman behind the counter looked up from her computer screen.
And how long will you be needing the vehicle for?
She asked.
Oh, just the day, began Simon.
A week, interjected Steve. We're heading up to Cape Canaveral later today, he added, giving Simon a let-me-do-the-talking look. Simon raised an amused eyebrow and stepped back to let Steve complete the booking.
Thanks, said Steve a few minutes later, when the woman handed him a paper wallet containing all the details of the rental.
You're welcome, sir, she said sunnily. Have a nice day.
Steve started to turn away.
Oh, he said suddenly, do you have a road map, something listing parking lots in the city?
It's all in the GPS unit, sir, said the woman.
I prefer the old-fashioned paper kind, insisted Steve.
The woman smiled politely and pointed to a series of shelves at the far end of the counter.
The green one should have everything you need.
Thank you, said Steve.
Steve helped himself to one of the maps, opened it briefly, and gave a small nod of satisfaction.
Let's go, he said to Simon. heading out to the forecourt, where a metallic blue Chevy Cobalt was waiting for them.
"Where to now?"
he asked, adjusting the seat and mirror to his satisfaction. "Are we going straight there?" He was a little surprised to feel a flutter of excitement in his belly.
"No," replied Simon. "We still have a few hours to kill. I booked us a room so we can freshen up and relax for a while."
"Whereabouts?" asked Steve, switching on the GPS unit and working his way through the menu.
"I thought you preferred the paper kind." "Just tell me where we're staying, psych boy."
Simon smiled and gave Steve the name. "Not exactly the Royal Palms, is it?" said Steve, as he grabbed his travel bag from the back seat of the car. The Bridge Hostel was a small complex of apartments used mainly by yacht crews from the innumerable craft moored up in Fort Lauderdale.
"It's clean and comfortable," said Simon, as they climbed the short flight of steps to the upper floor of the pink-colored building. Their apartment was basic, but more than adequate for their means. Two bedrooms with a shared bathroom and a small kitchen dining area.
Steve took a shower first while Simon grabbed the chance to lie down on a proper bed for a while. He lay on the comfortable mattress and closed his eyes. Here in the bright Florida sunlight, he could almost convince himself that he was safe. But he knew that he was not. Distance was no bar to the evil that stalked him. Still, the temptation to forget the James Randi Foundation and stay in the U.S. for as long as possible was incredibly strong. And yet he knew he could not do it, knew he would not do it. If he was to die, then the world should at least know that he'd existed, that someone like him had existed. No, he would go back. He would just close his eyes for a while. Simon started from sleep.
"It's all yours," said Steve, tousling his hair with the towel and bending over the street map that was laid out on the breakfast bar.
Simon felt a strange kind of disorientation as he picked up the towel from the end of his bed and made his way through the apartment towards the bathroom. Steve now had his elbows on the map and was tracing a route with his finger.
"Yep," he said pensively, "that will do nicely."
He tapped the map with his fingertips and walked over to his jacket. He did not notice the distracted expression on Simon's face, or the stiffness with which he held himself.
"Here are the keys to the apartment," he said, laying them down on the counter. "Lock the door when I go out and don't open it for anyone but me."
"Where are you going?" asked Simon in a voice that seemed to echo in his ears. To Simon, the room was growing suddenly darker, as someone on the other side of the world was waking up from a deeply troubled sleep. And with consciousness came the fear. Fear so great that it eclipsed everything, even the brilliance of the midday Florida sun.
"To rent a car," said Steve, as he opened the door to the apartment.
"But we already have a car." Simon began to tremble.
"You concentrate on the $1 million challenge," said Steve, checking his wallet for the money he would need. "Leave the escape and evasion to me."
He tucked his wallet back into his pocket and grabbed the handle of the door.
"You look wrecked," he told Simon. "Get yourself a shower. I won't be long."
And with that, he shut the door and left. Simon just stood there, unable to move as the fear crept like a foul smell into his world.
"Steve,"
he breathed in the barely audible voice of a frightened little boy.
"Steve,"
he said again, as the tears rolled down his cheeks. But Steve was gone. Simon was on his own.
Chapter 12. He was naked. He was cold. He was terrified. The psychiatrist tried to get up, but found that he could not. His hands were tied behind his back, and his feet, too, were bound. A wire gag had been drawn tight across his mouth, forcing him to breathe through his nose in short, shallow gasps, and the presence of a soggy, unidentifiable mass in his mouth made him want to retch. He was lying on his side, on bare flagstones, that felt cold, dank, and tacky against his skin. Beside him lay a copy of his book, silencing the voices. The front cover was missing. Struggling up through the cloying mire of unnatural sleep, he tried to focus his eyes on his gloomy surroundings. He appeared to be in some kind of church or chapel. There were church pews, the aisle between them leading to a studded wooden door with a black cross carved into it. With painful torpidity, he craned his neck to look round behind him. An altar, a heavy marble altar, a large unlit candle at either end. In the wall behind the altar, a stained glass window, the fractured panes of colour rendered dull and lifeless by the meagre light of distant street lamps. And there, on the bare stone walls, hung a large wooden crucifix. But something was wrong. The crucifix looked wrong. The psychiatrist stared at the crucifix, but his strained vision and groggy mind could not make sense of it. All he knew was that this symbol of love and deliverance brought him no comfort, no comfort at all. He was still staring at the crucifix when a door opened. Not the large main door, but a small postern door to the side of the altar. The psychiatrist twisted round, his mind igniting with hope and fear in equal measure. Hope vanished, the fear remained. A man had entered, a large, broad-shouldered man, dressed like a church acolyte in a black cassock and white lace-trimmed cotter. He approached the altar, head bowed, one hand shielding the small flame of the taper that he carried close to his chest. He reached the central aisle, turned to face the altar, and genuflected, his trailing foot coming within inches of the terrified psychiatrist. He rose, and stepping up to the altar, he lit the right-hand candle. Then he genuflected once more before crossing the altar to light the candle on the left. He blew out his small wax taper and placed it on a wooden table to the side of the altar. Then, from the table, he lifted a small silver bell and gave it a little shake. The bright, tinkling refrain sounding strangely obscene in the grim confines of the chapel. The psychiatrist was shaking uncontrollably, arching himself round, trying to keep the sinister acolyte in view. The acolyte came to stand beside the prone figure of the psychiatrist, who cowered at his feet, too frightened even to look up at his captor. Then suddenly the acolyte bent down and grabbed the psychiatrist by the arms, hauling him from the floor to stand awkwardly before the altar. The psychiatrist cried out in pain as the cord around his wrists bit into the flesh, tearing the skin. He felt blood running down his hand, dripping from his fingertips. But he felt something else, too. He felt the cord slip in the wetness, felt his swollen hand squeezing through the lubricated grip of the ligature. From the corner of his eye, the psychiatrist saw the acolyte make the sign of the cross.
"Amen," said the acolyte, in a deep, guttural voice.
There was a short pause in which the psychiatrist tried to free his hand without drawing attention to it.
"And also with you," said the acolyte, as if in answer to the blessing from an absent priest.
With a small mutinous jerk, the psychiatrist's hand came free. He flicked a fearful glance to his side as he tried to work some feeling back into his numb fingers. Then, knowing he had only one chance, he clenched his fingers and formed a bloody fist. Beside him, the acolyte bowed his head and closed his eyes.
"I confess to Almighty God, and to you, my brothers and sisters," he began.
The psychiatrist held his breath, tried to adjust his balance,
"that he has sinned through his own faults, in his thoughts and in his words, in what he has done, in what he has failed to do."
The psychiatrist struck with all the force of desperation. His fist made solid contact with his captor's jaw, snatching the acolyte's unsuspecting head to one side. The psychiatrist swiveled his bound feet and struck again,
another good blow striking home. He aimed a third, feeling the hope well up in his naked chest. But his hope was crushed, as were his fingers, by the massive hand that closed around his fist. He tried to strike with his other hand, but the acolyte caught hold of his wrist and drew himself up to his full, intimidating height. The psychiatrist looked up into eyes that were as black and expressionless as coal. He was paralyzed by the utter darkness of the man's gaze. For a terrible moment, the acolyte looked down upon the psychiatrist with his dead, black eyes. Then, with savage speed, he smashed his head down into the psychiatrist's face. The psychiatrist collapsed under the brutal attack as his nose and the orbit of his left eye were broken. The acolyte dragged the semi-conscious man across the floor to the foot of the wall beneath the inverted crucifix. Then he stepped back and disappeared through the small postern door. Now, struggling to breathe through the gag and his broken nose, the psychiatrist began to cry, the tears seeping out from his badly swollen eye. With his good eye, he looked around to see where his tormentor had gone, praying that he would not return. His prayers went unanswered. The acolyte returned, and what he carried in his hands made the psychiatrist recoil in horror. In his right hand, the acolyte carried a large black hammer. In his left, a fistful of long, thick nails. Pathetically, the psychiatrist tried to shuffle away, but the acolyte caught hold of him and pushed him to the floor. He knelt on his wrist and put one large nail in the center of his palm. The psychiatrist let out a stifled cry, trying in vain to pull his arm free. With his free arm, he battered ineffectually at the acolyte's head and shoulders. Then he screamed as the hammer came down, and the nail punched through his hand, giving a muted ring as it struck the hard paving stones beneath. The psychiatrist began to lose consciousness as the acolyte moved to his other hand. He gave a tortured moan as the hammer fell a second time. The acolyte grabbed the psychiatrist's right arm and pulled him up until his hand was level with the crosspiece of the large wooden crucifix. With one huge hand, he held it steady, while with the other, he drove the nail deep into the thick piece of solid oak. He repeated the procedure with the psychiatrist's left hand and stepped back. The psychiatrist was now unconscious once more. Hanging limply from the inverted crucifix, his body formed a grotesque mirror to the depiction of Christ that hung on the wall above him. Lucifer looked down at the heretic, the imagery not going unnoticed. He put down the hammer and returned to his place before the altar. Then he bowed his head and continued with the service that had been so inexcusably interrupted. "I thought I told you to lock the door," said Steve, as he re-entered the apartment, carrying a bag of food that he had picked up from a nearby store. He shut the door and looked round the room. Seeing no sign of Simon, he started for the bedroom. Then he stopped in his tracks, the brown paper bag falling from his grasp. "Oh, shit!" cursed Steve as he caught sight of Simon. Simon was leaning unnaturally against the wall, head bowed, arms stretched out wide, the backs of his hands pressed flat against the wall, and in the center of each hand a blood-black bruise that looked fresh and intensely painful. "Simon," said Steve, coming to kneel before him. "Simon, can you hear me?" Steve reached up to help Simon into a more comfortable position. His legs were not even straight beneath him, and Steve could not see how he was holding himself up. He put his hands under Simon's armpits and began to take his weight. As Simon's hands came away from the wall, he drew a rasping breath and collapsed into Steve's embrace. "It's okay," said Steve, lowering him gently to the floor. Simon began to sob. "Simon, it's okay. I've got you now," repeated Steve, trying to reassure him,
But Simon clutched at Steve's chest, turning his face to look up at him.
Jesus, breathed Steve at the sight of Simon's face. He looked as if he'd taken a good beating. His nose and brow were badly bruised, his left eye almost closed with the swelling.
He crucified him, sobbed Simon. Oh, God! Steve, he crucified him.
Who, Simon? He asked. Who did this to you?
Not me,
protested Simon, trying to push away from Steve.
Him!
He said it with conviction.
He crucified him.
Steve felt his blood run cold. Despite his years of dealing with violence, he felt suddenly out of his depth. Simon slumped back against the wall while Steve knelt before him.
He's going to kill me,
said Simon, with dreadful certainty.
No, said Steve, reaching out to gently cup Simon's chin. He stared at Simon, looking directly into the clear, grey depths of his unblemished eye.
No, he is not.
Then you must, said Simon.
Steve's jaw bunched and he closed his eyes. Not this again, he thought.
But you would, pleaded Simon, if it was the only way to save me from him. You would, wouldn't you, Steve?
Steve opened his eyes to look at Simon once more. He said nothing. He still refused to accept this nonsense about killing Simon, and yet there was a hardness and unflinching resolution to his gaze that seemed to offer Simon some comfort.
Thank you, said Simon, and finally his breathing began to calm.
You can't, said Steve, a half hour later when he had tended to Simon's injuries and they were sitting together at the breakfast bar.
Yes, I can, said Simon, putting down the ice pack and stuffing the last piece of a cinnamon and raisin bagel in his mouth.
He winced as he brushed a few crumbs from the bandages that Steve had applied to his bruised hands.
Just call them. Tell them you've had an accident.
Steve could not believe how quickly Simon had recovered from his earlier state of distress. He also found it impossible to believe that Simon's injuries were the result of something that had been done to someone else on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. And yet...
No,
said Simon, draining his can of Pepsi and rising somewhat unsteadily from his stool. We'll take the $1 million challenge in. He looked at his watch. Just over half an hour.
You're sure?
Pressed Steve. Absolutely, insisted Simon. He reached for his canvas bag and Steve shouldered it for him.
Besides, said Simon, with a glint in his one good eye, I can't wait to see James Randi's face when he signs over that check.
Steve shook his head as they started for the door.
You've a wicked streak in you, young man, he said.
You have no idea, replied Simon with a smile.
How can you smile? Asked Steve. With all this going on, how do you stay so damn cheerful?
Simon stopped in the doorway and looked back at Steve.
Have you ever known someone who lived with constant pain? He asked.
Yes, said Steve, remembering his mum in the last few years of her life.
And did she ever smile?
Steve closed the door to the apartment.
All the time, he said, as he turned the key in the lock. All the time.
Simon smiled and nodded gently. Then together they descended the steps, climbed into their hire car, and headed for the James Randi Educational Foundation, an institution whose very existence was based on the premise that true paranormal phenomena could not be shown to exist. They were about to learn otherwise.
Chapter 13.
We should have turned right there, said Simon, turning in his seat to look down Davy Boulevard, on which the Randi Foundation was situated.
Chill out, said Steve, watching the road ahead of them. We're just taking a small detour with plenty of time.
There was a note of confident satisfaction in Steve's voice that Simon found pleasing. He settled back in his seat, content to leave his fate in Steve's hands. He felt no desire
to know where they were going. He was enjoying the fact that Steve knew what he was doing. That was enough. For a few minutes, they continued north up South Andrews Avenue before taking a right and stopping outside a multi-story car park. Steve pulled into the side, unbuckled his seatbelt, and dug in his pocket for some loose change. "I'll just be a minute," he said, looking at Simon to make sure he was okay with that. Simon gave him a nod of reassurance, and Steve climbed out of the car. He walked quickly towards the parking lot and disappeared inside. Simon waited. He saw two cars enter the lot and one emerge from the exit, the security barrier rising smartly.